You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to the Ready Room. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including a lot of Shatner, a little Vic Fontaine, some photon torpedoes, and whether or not the Borg is the ultimate social network. Also, some interesting comments about Star Trek from the Robot Chicken producer, Amazon streaming Star Trek, the end of Star Trek Vanguard, and the 2011 Hallmark keepsakes. In our feature, Greg and I will embark on the Great Tribble Hunt, as we talk about Tribbles in the original series, the animated series, and Deep Space Nine. So, let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How are you today?
I am doing fantastically. The typhoon has moved on and left me with a sunny, sunny day.
Oh, you're lucky. You're a little bit further away from it than we are. It's passing through here, and today we're going to be putting my mic's sensitivity to the test because I am essentially coming to you today from inside a wind tunnel.
Oh, wow.
It's pretty wild here. The typhoon has really been going by. This is a Typhoon number 6 that's passing by, and I feel like I'm on SETI Alpha 5. It's just, it has been wild. We have a very dense woods right behind the studio here, and the trees, it sounds like I'm underneath a waterfall since last night. Very wild. But anyway, mentioning SETI Alpha 5, you know, Khan used to be there, and Khan was there because he was abandoned there by a certain Starfleet captain named James T. Kirk.
That's right. And James
played
T.
by William Shatner.
Yes. And he was in the news this week a little bit for his Google Plus account being shut down temporarily. Now, what is Google Plus? We know about Twitter. We know about Facebook.
Well, and we also know about Google. Mm. And I mean, I think it's obvious. It's Google Plus. Plus more.
Right, right.
It's more Google for your enjoyment.
More Google in your life.
Well, of course, I think, you know, our listeners are Star Trek fans, techie people, so most have probably heard of Google Plus at this point. I know a lot of our friends are already on Google Plus, and we've got them in our circles.
Right.
And it's a bit of Facebook, a bit of Twitter, no character count limit.
Yes, it's very nice.
Everyone knows, of course, Twitter's famous 140 character count limit, but Facebook also has a 420 character count limit when you try to post an update that drives me up the wall. And
yeah, it always seems to get in the way. And you can't post like videos or animated GIFs have become quite popular on Google+. There's many more things you can put into a post that make it more live.
Right, exactly. And so that makes it a great use for William Shatner and also other Star Trek casts, like Will Wheaton has been posting so much stuff.
Pretty much every 5 minutes there's something by Will Wheaton.
Yeah. It does seem that way, doesn't it?
Or Felicia Day.
Yeah, right. But in the case of William Shatner, it seems that what he did wrong is that he was being nice and saying hello to everybody who put him in their circle, which was great. You know, I mean, I love that William Shatner, Will Wheaton, and a lot of the cast of Star Trek really interact with the fans through social media and actually answer you and say hello to you in a case like this. But apparently Google Plus wasn't very happy with that, and they flagged his account for, quote, violating standards.
Yeah. I wonder if they weren't sure if it was actually him and thought maybe it was a spammer trying to use his name just to promote something.
That's probably the case. I'll give them the benefit of the doubt there and say that's probably the case, and maybe they thought that the activity was unusual. But I'm sure that they were all red-faced there at Google when they found out that they had shut down the account of Captain James T. Kirk.
Yes.
But it was only down for a few hours, and they confirmed with Shatner that it was indeed the good captain, and they got the account back up.
Yeah, now he's back up and posting, and actually I'm loving his posts. If you're on Google Plus, you should definitely follow William Shatner. Very informative stuff. He actually just posted a video this morning, as we're recording, of his first meeting with Scott Bakula, which was quite an event.
Oh, yeah.
somehow they had managed to never quite cross paths, but they finally did for his new documentary called The Captains, where he's interviewing all of the different Star Trek captains over the years.
Exactly. And that's actually our next news item here. I mean, StarTrek.com did an interview with William Shatner this week, two-parter. We record this on Thursdays. Mm-hmm. And so the first part came out yesterday, second part is out today. And especially the first half of this interview is all about the captains.
Mm. Right. And he talked about how he talked to all five other captains, Patrick Stewart, Avery Brooks, who started as a commander, became a captain, Kate Mulgrew, Scott Bakula, and even Chris Pine from the new movie. And he talked about the different things he was able to learn about how they approached playing a Star Trek captain, which I think would be... I really can't wait to see this documentary. It's a little bit hard from just hearing him talk about it to see how much quality there is from it, but it sounds like he went into this really wanting to find out some different things.
Yeah, it does. I hope that we'll be able to see it soon. We have to figure out logistically from Japan here,
right,
how we're going to get to see this since it's on Epix. But yeah, he said that he discovered a lot of similarities in the traits and tendencies amongst all the actors who have portrayed captains on Star Trek. And, you know, I don't know if that, I guess we'll find out in the documentary whether that comes from their traits and tendencies prior or if it's an influence of playing on Star Trek for all those years that they all kind of gain these certain tendencies as a result of that role.
Yeah.
And here, after the fact, you know, they kind of discover that. But
yeah,
it'll be very interesting to see.
Yeah, I felt like, especially Scott Bakula, who I'd seen in many other roles before being a Star Trek captain, he really brought a new, like he played a captain, not just Scott Bakula on the bridge. And I felt he was actually the closest to Kirk of all the other captains. Some of them, like Patrick Stewart, was doing very much Patrick Stewart, like a Shakespearean captain, and Avery Brooks was doing this very wildly different character that we'd never seen before. And of course, Kate Mulgrew, being the only female captain, sort of wavered between doing this motherly thing and more of a militaristic captain than we'd seen before. So they ended up having very different sensibilities. So I'd be definitely interested to see what he thought of as being the main similarity between all of them. What thread is between all the captains?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, that's going to be on Epix, and we have a little more information on that coming up here as well. And the in addition to this, in part two, they asked him, moving on from the captain's documentary, they also asked him a few questions that fans will want to know from past Trek. One that we talked about on here a few weeks ago when we talked about Malcolm McDowell is Star Trek Generations and the death of Kirk. And they asked Shatner that if he had a do-over on Generations, first of all, would he still agree to let Kirk die? And secondly, would he change the way that Kirk died in that film? Would he stand up more for that? And what did he say about that?
Yeah, he said he would be more courageous about suggesting or demanding a more regal exit. And I think, well, we've talked about the writer's strike really affecting the latest movie and making it make a little less sense than it should. I think the Next Gen finale really got in the way of Generations and didn't allow them to really put as much thought into all of this stuff. Maybe if Shatner had really stood up and said, no, I'm not letting Kirk die. You know, at first it was with a gunshot to the back, and then I guess he sort of died falling off a ladder or something. That part of the movie is very blurry for me.
That's a good point. You know, the writer's attention was so split between writing All Good Things and writing Generations essentially at the same time, you know, and they've talked about how they had to kind of keep straight in their heads which story they were writing, what were they working on at the time. And there was so much going on also with the transition of the Next Generation crew from the small screen to the big screen.
Right.
And then kind of lost in all that was the fact that for whatever reason, the studio felt like they had to actually kill Kirk in order to move on with the franchise, which I'm not so sure that was even necessary in the first place.
Yeah.
but they felt like they had to do it. And yeah, but it was kind of an afterthought, I guess. And I think what William Shatner said here was that he says, I'm not quite sure why he did it, but he allowed Kirk to have an ignominious ending.
Yeah.
And he says he wasn't really aware of the implications on a broader level until after it happened. So kind of looking at it in hindsight, he realizes that maybe he should have stood up for that and made it a more fitting ending for Kirk.
Yeah, I wonder if he agreed to the movie thinking it was just going to be a cameo, and then the role shifted as the script got written, and he just wasn't quite following it. And I bet he just got the script and said, oh, Kirk's dying. All right, well, this is going to be my last film anyway. That's fine. What probably became clear after the fact and with the fan response was everyone was so attached to this character that it was a much bigger deal than just Shatner's last movie. It's actually, you're killing Kirk. You're allowing him to not have any more adventures after this movie. He's basically finished in your imagination.
Right. You're killing a part of Star Trek.
Right.
You're not killing a character. I mean, you're killing one of the probably four icons of Star Trek, being Kirk, Spock, McCoy, and the Enterprise.
Right.
From the original, like the four biggest icons. So,
yeah,
well,
it was like there was
anyway, that was his answer.
Yeah.
That was his answer to that. And then they asked him about a couple of other things, you know, what he's working on now. He's working on a book called Shatner Rules, Your Guide to Understanding the Shatnerverse and the World at Large. And he's also, now I found this part interesting, he's working on another CD. Everyone knows the famous attempts by William Shatner to sing in the past, Rocket Man and so forth. Now, have you heard the album that he released in 2004, I believe it was, called Has Been?
I actually have. That's the one produced by Ben Folds and has some really fantastic songs. I'm trying to remember the name of the cover song he did. It was just really fantastic.
That's Common People.
Exactly, Common
that
People
was,
by Pulp.
Yeah, the anthem. And he did a cover of that with Ben Folds and with Joe Jackson, who people will remember from the 80s from songs like Steppin' Out and so forth.
And, of course, in that one, William Shatner didn't try to sing, which many people were happy for. It was mostly spoken word, which he's very good
at. It is. I mean, you know, Has Been is, I think there are a lot of people who probably have not heard this album because they think, oh, it's an album, it's William Shatner, it's music, and they remember Rocket Man, and they don't want to give it a shot. But if you haven't heard this album, I mean, you really have to listen to this because this is a brilliant album produced by Ben Folds. It's got Brad Paisley on there. It's got Joe Jackson. It's got a lot of guests on there and just a lot of really great tracks. The song called Real, which was written by Brad Paisley, who at least country fans know Brad Paisley. He's one of the biggest names in country music these days. And he's one of the few kind of throwbacks in country music. Take it back to real country roots. And Paisley is a big Star Trek fan and grew up watching the original series and the movies. Hmm. And he brought in William Shatner. Prior to Has-Been, he had William Shatner come in a couple of concerts, and they have a few spoken
pieces
together.
Wow.
And this song, Real, it's one of my favorite songs. Of all time, actually. And it's written by Brad Paisley. It's William Shatner narrating. You know, most everything on this album is spoken word. Mm-hmm. Shatner's not singing on here. So it really plays up to his strength, which is his voice and his presentation. But this song is basically about William Shatner talking to everyone about how he's not Kirk.
Mm, right.
But meaning it in the sense that you think of William Shatner as Kirk, as this hero who beat the Kobayashi Maru, you know, and never faces death. And the song is very touching, and this definitely is a great album. But this new album, anyway, going back to where we were, that he's doing, is apparently him performing space-inspired heavy metal tracks.
Yeah, I don't know what quite that means. Is it going to be basically the same as Has-Been, but with wailing guitars, or is he gonna actually start singing this time? And what is space inspired? I'm hoping that doesn't mean it has the Casio boom, ba boom, 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 from last episode we were talking about.
We'll find out. If there's a track on here called Station DX7, then I'm gonna be really worried. But yeah, this is gonna feature Shatner with John Winter, Brad Paisley, Warren Haynes, Peter Frampton, Zakk Wylde, Toots, and Ernie Watts. And I really don't know. I'm just gonna have to wait and see on this
Yeah.
one. I'm not a big heavy metal fan in the first place, so I'm not gonna be quite as on this as I am on Has Been probably. But if it follows the pattern of Has Been, where it's more spoken word mixed with music and it has good production to it, I might get into it.
Right, now, if you'd asked me 10 years ago which Star Trek actors would be the most active in 2011, I don't think I would have said Will Wheaton and William Shatner. But I'm really glad to see that that's the case, because everything he does, is it Has Been, if it's that TV show he did, all the stuff on his Twitter and Google Plus accounts, really interesting, always engaging. I love that he's still making stuff.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it seems like he'll never stop.
Yeah.
I picture William Shatner being like 130 and still being on TV shows, and
Yep.
seems like he'll never stop. Speaking of music, the next item we have is another interview. And this is an interview with your favorite character from Deep Space Nine, Greg.
I love every time on DS9 where they'd have a Bajoran religion episode, and to talk about religion, they would go and listen to Vic Fontaine. It just warms my heart, warms it.
Yeah, as listeners will know, if they listened to our show from last week when we had our DS9 feature, both you and a friend of the show, Brian Finifter, are not huge Vic Fontaine fans,
Right.
whereas I love Vic Fontaine, probably because of my background, playing
Right.
jazz over the years. I thought this was a really great addition to the show because late DS9 was really getting very heavy.
That's true.
And having this character on the show and having this club, Vegas club that they could go to kind of get away from this war that was going on, I thought was needed. And it gave a kind of a flavor to the show that that really enhanced Deep Space Nine for me. But what's interesting in this is that the casting of this, actually, they brought in James Darren because, again, a lot of fans may not know James Darren. But he is a singer that goes back a long way. I mean, he's a contemporary of the Rat Pack
Right.
with Sammy Davis Jr. and Frank Sinatra and all those guys. And to have him on the show lent a kind of connection to the past for me, I think for a lot of jazz fans. And Ira Stephen Baer was a big fan of the Rat Pack, which is, as Brian said on the show last week, often the producers have a fondness for the time period, and that's how
Right.
these things get pulled into shows. And he's exactly right, and that's what happened here.
Yeah. It's interesting to me that they invented a new singer and didn't just have an impersonator be, Frank Sinatra in the show, as they've done like Leonardo da Vinci, Einstein, and various other people. They wanted to create a new character.
Well, I think they probably did that. One reason they probably did that is because if you had Frank Sinatra and you just had an impersonator or you had an actor playing Frank Sinatra, it's not going to work for the viewer to have Frank Sinatra helping Nog
Right.
get over the fact that he lost a leg, or have Frank Sinatra in the middle of this kind of blossoming love affair between Odo and Kira.
Right.
But having a separate character like Vic Fontaine there, then it works fine.
Right.
I think that's probably one of the reasons. But James Darren, I mean, apart from being a singer for a long time, he also had a kind of a little bit of a Trek connection in the past in that he was on T.J. Hooker with William Shatner. He was also in a lot of other TV shows and films, like the Gidget, where he played Moondoggy, and he was on a sci-fi show called The Time Tunnel,
which I've never heard of before, but it sounds like he was quite active in this sort of, not the golden age, maybe between the golden age of TV and the 80s. He just did a lot of these T.J. Hooker time tunnel shows.
Yeah, would we call that the rabbit ears age, maybe?
That sounds about right.
And he also did a lot of directing on television, again, for T.J. Hooker and mm-hmm. the A-Team and Beverly Hills 90210, which could have inspired that Starfleet Academy series that we talked
right.
about a few shows back. But another great album. Again, if you like jazz and you like Deep Space Nine, in 1999, Darren released an album called This One's From the Heart, which is another album that I have and I listen to often.
Oh, yeah?
And it has all the songs that Vic Fontaine performed on Deep Space Nine.
Oh, that would be great to hear. I should search that out. And as much as I am unsure of the episodes themselves, I did love the music that came in. I have a fondness for jazz music and for a lot of that Rat Pack style crooning music. So I'd love to hear this album. And it's interesting to me that he actually sang songs written for Star Trek. Do you know where those songs came from? Were they...
Well, yeah, most of them are jazz classics. I don't know that there were any songs written,
okay.
actually written for Deep Space Nine.
Okay.
They're all jazz classics. You know, things like It's Only a Paper Moon. And then in What You Leave Behind, when he performs The Way You Look Tonight, you know, classic song.
Okay.
And that's the other thing that got for me was that the way this connected, I mean, the juxtaposition of I'll Be Seeing You when during the battlefield scene with the Jem'Hadar
right.
in the siege of AR-558 when Nog lost his leg. I mean, it was so dramatic and it was unexpected.
Right.
It was very unique. And that was something that Vic Fontaine allowed them to do on Star Trek that, you know, they could never do in the past and haven't done since either.
Right.
And in What You Leave Behind, when they're all about to go their separate ways and they're all gathered in the club and he's singing The Way You Look Tonight, was, for the viewer, was very touching, I think, because you've been through this whole series and this whole war with the cast, and that kind of emotional connection, I think, could not have been made if this Vic Fontaine character had not existed on the show, for me anyway, not to the level that it was.
Right.
And they talk about how especially Nana Visitor was just crying while they're trying to shoot this. And then James Darren says he starts crying because Nana's crying. And it was just a great addition to Deep Space Nine, I think.
Yeah.
And the interview was interesting. They talked to him a bit about how he got the part and why he decided to do it.
Yeah, so he says a few things. They were looking for someone like Frank Sinatra. So they looked at Frank Sinatra Jr., Jerry Vale, Tom Jones, Steve Goulet. And I imagine at least Frank Sinatra Jr., if he wasn't already a Star Trek fan, was probably not interested in doing a show like this. He'd probably think it was a little bit beneath him, as he was already pretty famous and connected with his father. But James Darren maybe had a place in his heart for Star Trek, or they pitched it so well to him that he became interested in doing it. Especially, he says, I don't have the whole interview in front of me, but he says he learned there was going to be more for him to do than just singing.
Right.
So he'd been an actor, and to be an actor and a singer on a show like this must be an interesting experience.
Yeah, well, of course, he was a singer, actor, director, mm-hmm. and so he said he didn't want to just play a singer. He didn't want to just stand in the club and just sing songs.
Right.
And so when he found that there would be more to do, he was more interested in doing it.
Yeah.
And he says he was not sure if it was originally supposed to be a one-off or a recurring character, but of course it grew into a recurring character.
Yeah, how many episodes did he end up being in? Somewhere between around 20 or so, wasn't it? It was quite a few.
Oh, boy. You know, that's a good question, and I don't know off the top of my head. I don't think it was that many, but it was quite a few. I was going to say maybe like six or eight or so.
Okay.
I have to look that up
that
and
could
see.
Be. It could be fewer than I felt. I know in the last few seasons, it just felt like every few episodes they were going back to Vic, and he was just becoming much more regular character than I expected, I think, when he first showed up. And that happens on shows from time to time. You bring someone on for one episode, and then he either connects with the other actors or he connects with the audience, and you just want to keep bringing him back whenever you can.
Yeah, right. Yeah, maybe it feels that way. I don't think there were quite as many as you felt. It's kind of like, you know, this came up on Twitter a while back. Someone was saying that Voyager became too reliant on the holodeck to the point that it was like the holodeck series. But if you stop and think about it, I think that the Next Generation used the holodeck quite a bit more than Voyager did.
Certainly did, yeah.
It's just a perception, you know, that it feels like that. So I think maybe it felt like... Yeah. They were going to Vic more often than
I had this memory of Captain Proton being like half of Voyager for the last three seasons or so. And then when I actually went back and watched it, there were maybe two, maybe three Captain Proton episodes in the entire series. So these things probably grow in my imagination the longer I go without watching.
Yeah, right. And they also asked him what were some of his favorite episodes. Mm-hmm. And of course, His Way, which was his first appearance. And What You Leave Behind, which I just mentioned because of the emotional tug there. He also mentions the Emperor's new cloak. And this is another funny thing about how he became part of the crew, even though he was a holodeck character and kind of a lounge singer, that they actually had a mirror universe Vic Fontaine.
Yeah, that was really cool.
Star Trek. Yeah.
I definitely loved the alternate universe episodes of DS9, and including him was just fine with me. I loved his role in that one.
They did a really good job with the mirror universe in DS9.
Yeah.
That's another thing.
Yeah.
People think of the mirror universe as Mirror Mirror from the original series and the two-parter in Enterprise, but it was actually DS9 that did the most with the mirror universe.
Definitely. And let me ask you a question, Chris. In the Mirror Universe, what do captains love to shoot at other ships?
Do they shoot tribbles at other ships?
Tribbles, that's good. They like to shoot photon torpedoes, Chris. They like blowing them up, not just annoying them.
Of course. Of course. All right. Yes, photon torpedoes, weapons with great destructive power and a staple of Star Trek.
Definitely.
And we have another new news item here with a science slant.
Yeah, I love
It's a science fiction or science fact.
Mm. Yeah, I love these approaches to Star Trek and trying to figure out, you know, is something actually physically possible for it to even exist? And if it did exist, what would it be? And of course, to date... The biggest weapons we have are these nuclear weapons we've created, which in Star Trek we've heard them talk about them being used during the Romulan War, which was between Enterprise and the original series. So at some point those nuclear weapons became phased out. And I believe they had photon torpedoes as early as the original series, although sometimes maybe they looked like phasers being shot depending on how much effects budget they had for that episode.
Right, but yeah, I do think that they had them at that point. On Enterprise, of course, they don't have photon torpedoes at the beginning of Enterprise, but as the series goes on and they get weapons upgrades, did they ever actually move up to photon torpedoes or not?
I'm trying to remember myself. I know there are other races at that point that have photon torpedoes.
Yeah.
And they have some sort of torpedoes, but I'm not sure if they called them photon torpedoes. They're definitely not those big, bright, like balls of light. There's, you know, lens flare across the screen. They're actual torpedoes with like a rocket on the back that they fire.
I'm
trying to remember what exactly those are called.
Yeah, I don't remember. We have to look up the technology on Enterprise and how it progressed, because they did progress it a bit during the four-year run of the series, so... but yeah, you know, we've talked about several different technologies on recent shows but that we see in Star Trek and how we're progressing towards those. And this is a science article that we found on TrekNews.net about how photon torpedoes work and what are some of the challenges of developing these ourselves if because eventually we're going to move out into space. And of course, unfortunately, eventually warfare is going to move out into space as well. Even if we never meet any aliens, it's just us humans fighting each other. It's going to happen.
Right.
And of course, you have no oxygen in space, which means that traditional bombs are not going to be able to function in space.
Yeah.
Because you don't have any combustible oxygen for an explosive device to work. So you have to have some other technology, and that's what we have in Star Trek and photon torpedoes.
Right. And it appears that photon torpedoes work in a similar way to the warp drives, in that they bring antimatter in contact with normal matter, whereas in a warp drive they control that with dilithium crystals. The photon torpedoes are much more of an uncontrolled combination, which causes a gigantic explosion. It says, if a typical warhead contains just 1 milligram of antimatter, a photon torpedo would release 180 million kilojoules, which it says is equivalent to 43 metric tons of TNT, which is quite a lot considering. But that's what you need in space, because these spaceships are so large and they're so heavily shielded.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, so the way this operates, like you're saying, it's kind of analogous to what we have right now with nuclear power plants versus nuclear weapons.
And right.
In one sense, we are controlling what's going on. In the other sense, we're just triggering it and letting the full explosive power.
Mm.
You go. I mean, I knew this is a very simplification, of course,
because
we don't want to get into a deep discussion
of
nuclear power or antimatter things. But that's just kind of the basic idea here of what's going on with photon torpedoes.
Right.
And this, of course, matter-antimatter reactions do not require oxygen, which is why this would be a suitable type of weapon to use in space, where you don't have that combustible oxygen.
Right.
So here's a question for you, Greg. Now, we have photon torpedoes throughout most of Star Trek, and then as we get into... Where did they first appear? Did they first appear in the movie First Contact?
That's right.
Yeah, I think so. We have quantum torpedoes, which become the weapon of choice throughout much of the Dominion War and Voyager.
That's right.
Now, what's a quantum torpedo?
Well, the difference is that photon torpedoes are basically large flashlights, and quantum torpedoes are subject to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle.
So I understand.
They might explode, they might not. You really don't want to look at them while they're on their way, because you might affect... their explosive output.
Ah, I see. So if you fire a quantum torpedo, you don't know if it exploded or not until you open the control hatch and look inside, right?
And look at the cat, exactly.
Right.
They actually develop them by shooting them at cats and find out what happened.
Oh, God. Well, I hope they were laser cats so they can fight back.
Oh, of course. You have to do something with the laser cats after you've invented them.
Right. And I think another difference is with a photon torpedo, when you fire it, you know exactly where it's going and when it explodes. But with the quantum torpedo, you can never know the direction or the explosive yield of the torpedo at the same time.
Yes, right? Exactly.
All right. Okay.
It,
so
it does appear that quantum torpedoes are simply modified photon torpedoes. They work in the same way. They're just, you know, more powerful.
They're more powerful.
Right.
Yeah, they're more powerful. I think it's basically photon torpedoes were starting to sound really 80s.
Yes.
And the writers needed something that sounded more powerful to fight the Borg and the Jem'Hadar.
Right.
And thus, quantum torpedoes were born.
Sure.
They're pretty much more or less the same thing,
yes.
I think. And if they're not, I'm sure we'll get a lot of messages from people telling us, like the letters that they got on TNG when they had a torpedo come out of a...
Right.
A phaser turret or vice versa, right? Which Rick Berman has talked about before.
Yes. Those fans.
You know, speaking of needing something more powerful to fight the Borg, this is not a science article, but it's more of a philosophical story, I guess, about the Borg. From Anthony Rotolo, who is a professor at Syracuse University and teaches a course called Star Trek in the Information Age. And this is called, Is the Borg the Ultimate Social Network?
Yeah, and this comes from an interesting perspective in that You know, as much as we joke about Chekhov logging into Twitter from the console of the Enterprise, we don't really see anything like the internet in Star Trek. And it's possibly born out of the fact that Star Trek comes from the 60s and then the 80s, when we thought computers were just going to be the computer sitting in front of you and maybe it would talk to another computer. But this whole web of computers around the world wasn't really something we thought about. And definitely, they've not given too much thought to how that will have progressed by the 24th century.
Yeah, science fiction in general is like that. There was... science fiction writers of the past were not able, apparently, to anticipate how computers would miniaturize and how ubiquitous they would become. So you see some disconnects there. And, of course, there was no Twitter. I think there was... Twitter existed back then, but it was just one continuous fail-well all the way up until now. And now when we see the fail-well, we think that Twitter is down. But actually, when we see Twitter functioning, we're just seeing the intermittent moments when it's beginning to come alive.
That makes sense.
From that continuous fail-well that goes back into the past. What Rotolo says here is... he's not exactly saying that the Borg are a social network or that we're all becoming the Borg, but his point is that the way that we use social media, especially Twitter, Facebook, and Google Plus, things coming on, is that we're all communicating in real time globally,
right,
all the time. You know, anything happens around the world and everybody is sharing information about it on the fly. And it's just really changed the way that we obtain information and the way that we process information.
Yeah, I was,
and of course, share that information.
Yeah, it's amazing how many times on a podcast like a twit.tv, when they have a question about, you know, can you do such and such or what is this thing, he can just ask Twitter or ask the chat room and a whole bunch of answers just instantly come back to him. Which is remarkably how the Borg work. They have a problem and they ask and all these answers come flooding back.
Exactly. Yeah. So his point is that we are at least we're starting down a road on which our minds in a way are all connected because when someone needs something, there are many other minds immediately accessible that start working together on a problem.
Yeah.
And this is kind of the beginning. And could this be like a road that the Borg once stood in front of, that they were purely organic and they started developing? Because it's not only this, you know, you see a lot of medical technology that's coming around with prosthetics now. You know, there's talk that within a very short time frame of like a decade or a few decades, we may begin to have implants in our brains that allow us to do things like communicate the way we do now with the telephone by nothing more than thought, that all these things come together to form what we know on Star Trek as the Borg Collective.
Right.
And maybe the Borg themselves, in fact, are the ultimate social network.
Yeah, it's interesting that Star Trek in some ways looks at alternate ideas of what could happen to humanity in the future. We've seen things like the augments, people like Khan, where we didn't go in that direction, whereas we actually quite could have at some point in the 20th century branched off into trying to create superhumans. And the Borg could be thought of as a way to think about what will happen if we continue to connect ourselves to each other and connect ourselves to computers. You know, will we lose an element of our humanity? You know, what does humanity mean in this context? And so it's a really... it's quite a bit of a can of worms that we could probably talk about for ages and ages, and maybe we will if we do a feature on the Borg. I think the main difference at the moment, at least, is all of this is voluntary. I have yet to go up and inject Twitter nanoprobes into someone and force them to communicate via Twitter. Perhaps soon I will get that. I've ordered it from Amazon, but they haven't arrived yet.
Oh, all right. Well, you know, when I'm not on the air here, I have just right over there, I have an alcove that I go and stand in at night to regenerate. It's quite peaceful, actually.
Nice. Did you get OS X Lion installed on your alcove this morning?
You know, I did. I did upgrade my alcove to Lion. It's great. Above the little green disc, glowing disc, I have a lion mane.
Oh, you know, very nice.
It's a great decor. And, you know, speaking of animals and mechanical ones at that,
yes,
we have another story from the Robot Chicken producer.
Yeah, Robot Chicken. Have you seen much of this show? It's an animated show on Cartoon Network in America that just deals with satire, especially of pop media.
I have seen some clips from Robot Chicken. I haven't really actually watched a show. I think what I've seen are some, there have been some Star Trek little segments.
Right.
Right. Some references anyway.
Right. It's very fast moving. Like they'll do just 10 seconds and then move on to the next thing. So it's really easy for them just to throw in a Star Trek reference between, you know, He-Man and I don't know what else they cover. They cover a lot of things. But recently they've been doing Star Wars specials where they actually go through Star Wars movies and find humor from them. And I guess people have been wondering, will they do a Star Trek one?
Well, in this story, you mentioned Star Wars, and that's kind of the point of the story. And what's I really just about fell out of my chair laughing when I read this, because what Robot Chicken producer Matt Sinreich says in this story is that he says that Star Trek is not deep or expansive enough to warrant its own episode.
Right.
And however, and here's the kicker, however, Star Wars is. So Star Trek, with its like 800 hours of content, is not deep or as expansive enough for an episode, although six Star Wars movies are.
Yeah, I think this is simply his own biases coming through. Because he says that in Star Trek, when he sees someone, he doesn't want to know that person's backstory. Whereas in Star Wars, if he's watching it, you know, he just sees one little alien. He's like, oh, I want to know, you know, where does he come? What does he do? There's no difference. It's still a guy in makeup that some production designer put in the corner of the screen. It's your own bias. It's what you're bringing to the show.
Yeah, I know. It's like, so he says here that, he said Star Trek was, okay, first of all, he says that Star Wars as a universe, it's so many worlds and planets and different characters that are roaming around. And, you know, it's different species interacting with different species. But Star Trek was the character of the week. It wasn't until later that you had them interacting in the political spectrum with all the different races at the same time. And it's really just the crew that you're following. And those are the only ones you know the stories of. And how much do you know of those other characters and races? Very little. Mm. I'm just thinking, maybe he's only watched like five episodes of Star Trek.
Right.
I mean, this doesn't make any sense to me.
Not really. And one argument I could buy is that as a whole, because there's so much less Star Wars, more people have seen it. And so it's easier for them to parody it and have an idea that you will understand the jokes. So it's almost the exact opposite. It's because Star Trek is so expansive and there's so much that he could pull from that maybe that means it's harder. Just like with our Trek trivia, there's so many little bits that it's hard for me to be able to answer the questions, even though I'm a pretty deep Star Trek fan.
Yeah. Well, see, now that's a good point. And if you put it that way, then I completely agree that it's there is so much ground to cover that it may be hard to focus it in on one little episode.
Right.
But that's not what he says. I mean, you know, says that, like, if you see some, he's basically saying, like, if you see Rom on Deep Space Nine, you're not interested in knowing anything about Rom. But if you see some guy with a squid face walk outside Mos Eisley, you want to know everything about this squid face guy.
Right.
It's just, it's purely it's Star Wars bias, purely. And that's fine. I mean, everyone's perfectly entitled to having their own view of this stuff. I just find it interesting that someone who's the producer of such a well-known show like Robot Chicken would actually come out and make the comment that Star Trek is not expansive enough to warrant its own episode. However, Star Wars is not only expansive enough, but I think he's already done like three dedicated episodes to Star Wars, right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, speaking of there being a lot of Star Trek to watch, Everyone knows about Netflix getting Star Trek streaming finally here earlier this month. But they're not the only ones who are going to have it.
Yeah, so Amazon has recently started their Amazon Prime instant streaming service, where subscribers to their Prime service get a few shows. It's been a really limited number to date. But there's a new story out that they're getting a bunch of things, including The Tudors, Numbers, Medium, Cheers, Frasier, and most interesting to us is the complete Star Trek franchise, which I'm not actually sure if that includes the TV shows or not. It sounds like it.
I'm sure it is, because CBS owns the rights to the Star Trek television franchise, right, whereas Paramount owns the rights to the Star Trek movie franchise.
Right. So it probably doesn't include the movies then.
Possibly. Unless Amazon already has a deal with Paramount, which is possible. Since we cannot access this from Japan, I don't know all the deals they have.
It's hard to know these things. Yeah. And so this also comes along with the announcement that Netflix has raised their prices for many customers. So I think Amazon might be trying to do so many things to pull people in. And I think the way this works out is Amazon's service is now actually cheaper than Netflix. It is $79 a year, I believe.
It might be. I mean, it's part of the Amazon Prime service, if I'm correct, in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And the Amazon Prime service is quite a bit more expensive in the U.S. than it is here in Japan for Amazon Japan. But, of course, we don't have video streaming or some of the other features that you get in the U.S. with Amazon Prime. But, you know, Amazon Prime itself has its advantages if you do a lot of shopping with Amazon. So the streaming video that you get from their catalog is just yet another bonus to that.
Right. It's a little strange. And I expect eventually they'll branch out this streaming to be its own service. It is kind of strange. Because it's sort of...
It's kind of strange kind of bundling it like that.
Yeah. It's a discount on your... purchases, which has nothing to do with streaming video, unlike Netflix, which it makes a lot of sense for them to include a streaming service.
You know what it's like for me, as you know, here in Japan, when you do something like if you go to a bank and you open a bank account, they have to give you gifts.
Right.
We have a very big gifting culture here. Mm-hmm. You give gifts for everything. And it's kind of like that. It's kind of like, oh, you have a bank account with this. Here's some tissue boxes and a towel and a cup.
Right.
You know, it's kind of like Amazon saying, like, oh, you have our special low-cost shipping service. Here's some streaming TV shows to go with.
That's right.
Kind of feels like that for me. So.
Well, I definitely say the entire Star Trek franchise is pretty good, better than a towel and a cup. And I love seeing...
It's definitely better.
I love seeing ways for people just to be able to hop on and watch Star Trek. Because actually going out and buying every single season DVD becomes pretty expensive, considering that there's six shows.
It definitely does. I mean, there are 28 sets to cover all six series. So, and yeah, I mean, you make a great point. You know, these deals that CBS... These are really smart deals, I think, that CBS is making. Because while on the one hand, it does possibly cut into sales of DVD box sets, what it really does is it makes Star Trek accessible to new fans. And now through Amazon and through Netflix streaming, I mean, this stuff costs you next to nothing. I mean, I know people are upset about Netflix raising the price, but it's still next to nothing. I mean, if you think about, you used to go to the video store and you used to rent movies. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're getting streaming for the whole month for the price of a couple of movies. And it's still about half of what we pay here in Japan for a Netflix type service.
Exactly.
So it's very inexpensive. And what CBS is doing is they're making the entire Star Trek franchise available to a whole new generation of fans who can go through and watch all these episodes. And it's great for us older fans as well, because it's just going to lead to a healthier Star Trek that's going to lead to yet more material for us. So I'm really happy about it.
Yeah, it's really great. So speaking of there being an awful lot of Star Trek out there, there's even this whole world of Star Trek that I'm not as familiar with, which is the Star Trek book series, and one that's been a big deal for the past few years, from what I understand, is Star Trek Vanguard. Do you know more about this? Can you fill me in a little bit?
Yeah, I know a little bit more about it. I don't get to read as much as I would like to, but one of the fun things about the books over the past decade is that they have... They're not just doing books that are the same old characters that we know from the series in new stories, or in the case of DS9, continuation of the series. They also do a lot of different series that bring new characters. Perhaps the most well-known is Peter David's New Frontier series, which pulls in some characters like Shelby, A-Rex, people like that that we know from other series. But there have been some that are completely unique, like this one, Star Trek Vanguard. And this is written by a group of writers, Dayton Ward, Kevin Dillmore, Marco Palmieri, and David Mack. And this is set in the TOS time period, but it does not feature the Enterprise or the usual crew. It's kind of a look at what else is going on in the Federation at the same time from what we get to see on the screen.
Right.
And it focuses on a starbase called Starbase 47, which is also known as Vanguard. And it just enables them to tell various stories and to use new characters and do things with those characters that really affect the lives of the characters in the Federation, which you can't necessarily do, you know, because you can't kill Kirk or Spock or you know, you can't destroy the Enterprise in the middle of the series, things like that. So it gives them more freedom to play.
It seems to me, from what I've read, it seems like they're doing original series DS9. Like they're
sort of, yeah.
They're being so different from the sort of exploratory missions we're used to. They're just putting it all on the station and being able to see, like, more of, not so much story of the week, but having a big, expansive, long storyline that people can really dig into.
Yeah, in that sense, that's probably a good way to describe. I mean, it's not necessarily that you're going in and they're not rehashing Deep Space Nine and putting it in TOS time period, but yeah, it's that kind of story where it's focused on a region of space, centered around a space station, centered more on the lives, the interaction, the characters, and they have more freedom to have consequences, like we talked about last week in DS9, consequences of what happens instead of hitting the reset button at the end of every episode. Yeah. So that's going on. This has been going on since 2006, and they've always planned it to be a story that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And they just recently are releasing a set of stories that continue on Vanguard, and now they've said that they're going to wrap up the storyline in 2012 with two final books.
Yeah, I really like the idea of having a planned storyline for this and sort of having it be like a TV show where it might be around for between 5 and 7 years and not just write another book, but actually have a real arc to it, like maybe Lost, the TV show, or maybe a more modern example would be the Song of Ice and Fire book series where he has it all mapped out, but it's just taking... maybe longer with that case, but you're able to follow it, follow every book, and get the next bit of a story. And they're not getting canceled like a TV show might be. They're getting to actually wrap everything up in the way they want to and give fans, hopefully, a satisfying conclusion.
That's right. Yeah, there's no like, wait a minute, we didn't sell enough books of the last one. Stop the presses.
Right.
And then toss everything out. That's right. Yeah, so Dayton Ward, he confirmed that they're ending the series, and he says that there's going to be the book, What Judgments Come. That's going to be the next one that's written by him and Kevin Dillmore together. And that's going to begin the conclusion of the Vanguard storyline. Mm. And then that's going to be followed by David Mack's book, Storming Heaven, which puts everything to rest and brings everything to a close.
Yeah.
So we're going to have a link in the show notes, not just for this, but all the other earlier stories we talked about as well, if you want to learn a little bit more about that.
Yeah, and so I'm hoping to be able to go back and read some of these. Now that it's coming to an end, it's sort of like picking up the DVD series of a series you didn't watch while it was on. And so if I end up really liking it, maybe we can talk about it in a future episode.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah, picking those up and just reading them straight through is another good way to get the whole story, like I do with a lot of TV shows these days. Well, speaking of bringing things to a close, as the year ends and the holiday season rolls around, a popular tradition for Star Trek fans has become to collect the keepsakes from Hallmark, which they put out everywhere, ornaments to decorate your tree or to just hang around the house. And they've announced the lineup for the 2011 collection as this year comes to a close. And they've got three entries this year that I think are going to be of great interest to fans of the original series.
Yeah, they look really great. I remember this series in 1995, I convinced my parents to get the Voyager keepsake ornament. We got one ornament for every year, and I got them to make it be the Star Trek one that time. So this year, the ones they have are the Romulan Bird of Prey that we saw in Balance of Terror, and the Mirror Universe Spock, mind-melding with Dr. McCoy from Mirror Mirror. And then lastly is a Spock ornament, which he stands just ready to scan, it says, in his blue science tunic. I've seen
maybe
pictures of him.
He's scanning for Santa.
Sort of like NORAD looks for Santa every year. In the future, it's Spock with his tricorder.
Just with his tricorder standing or hanging on your tree.
Yes. Now, do you have any of these ornaments? Do you do much Christmas stuff in Japan?
No, I mean, we do put up the tree for the kids, but we can't get these here. You know, these are only available in store at Hallmark, so we don't have access to them. And I'm trying to remember if I've ever had one of these. I want them. I would love to get them each year. When I lived in the States, you know, I was much younger and I didn't have any money. And so I couldn't buy these every year. I mean, you know, $32 for an ornament was way more than I could swing. So, and now I don't have access to the Hallmark store, so I can't get them. But if I could, I would definitely be picking up all three of these.
Yeah.
Especially the Bird of Prey.
Yeah, the Bird of Prey looks great. A story we don't have in this today is the salt and pepper shakers that looked really great. And they actually had one of those in the latest Star Trek movie. I believe it was actually the Kelvin at the bar at the beginning of the movie was a little salt shaker. And I would love
to
have
those. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah. Yeah, that was nice. Yeah, we had those salt shakers in Hyperchannel.
Yeah.
Actually, this, as we record here on Thursday, it was the current Hyperchannel. For the past week. Those look nice too.
They look great.
Along with the Enterprise pizza cutter that has been out. But at any rate, these are the three ornaments for Hallmark this year. And we'll have a link to this on our site and in the show notes as well. Mm-hmm. And also a link, StarTrek.com had some exclusive background information from the artists who created this year's keepsakes. Mm-hmm. And we'll have a link to that too if you want to hop over to StarTrek.com. And here are the thoughts behind the creative process of these.
Yeah, very cool.
So when the original series started, they focused on a lot of very serious issues, but that doesn't mean that they didn't take some time out to have some fun and play around a little bit. They did it in the first season on Shore Leave, but then in the second season, they did what became one of the most famous little lighthearted moments in Star Trek, and that was The Trouble with Tribbles. And today, we are going to talk all about the most fertile aliens in all of Star Trek, Tribbles. So Greg, do you have any Tribbles over there with you right now?
Oh, sorry. Tribbles took over my mic for a moment. Yes, actually.
Yeah, I see
them. I bought one at the pet shop last night, and suddenly I have a whole bunch of them. I don't know how this happened.
Oh,
apparently
no.
I did not learn my lesson.
I think you left your bag of Quadro Triticale open, didn't you? Or perhaps your Quinto Triticale.
Or perhaps. As there we go.
It became in the animated series.
Yes.
So This has always been one of my favorite episodes, definitely. And today we're just going to kind of have a kind of just a fun discussion about tribbles. For an alien that is not humanoid and has really only appeared a few times over the course of Star Trek, it's amazing how popular these little critters are. And you know, we have a hamster in here in the other room, and it's cute, but I have to wonder how much more fun it would be around here if we had a tribble.
Yeah, I saw the way Uhura looks at the tribble in the bar, and she is just astonished with how cute it is. And I have to think that maybe they were limited a little bit by budget in the 60s, and they couldn't quite make, because they kind of just look like a ball of fur. But I have to imagine in real life, somehow there's something about them that just makes them absolutely irresistible. I used to have a rabbit, and rabbits can be pretty adorable too, but there's some draw these tribbles have. And even non-Star Trek fans know what a tribble is.
Yeah, that's right, they do. And yeah, maybe it's something about the fur, maybe it's something about the cooing sound, or maybe they emit some kind of pheromones that have an effect on humans, but of course not on Klingons.
That's right. They seem to hate Klingons. And
Klingons hate them.
Now that must come from, we know that the Klingons hunted the Tribbles down in the Great Tribble Hunt. And so that must be why the Tribbles have such an aversion to them. But it's astonishing to me that they're born with an aversion to Klingons.
Well, it's what your parents pass on
That's
to.
Right. Do you think the Tribbles tell stories to their children at night of the Great Tribble Hunt and the Klingons coming after them?
Oh, yeah, that's right. And, well, the Great Tribble Hunt comes from a line from Deep Space Nine, right? With Odo and Worf sitting at the table, and Odo being kind of sarcastic to Worf, like, oh, do they still sing songs of the Great Tribble Hunt? And Worf looks very irritated.
I wanted Worf to just say, of course they do.
Of course they do. That's right. We have a statue. Yes.
Stabbing a tribble through the heart.
The tribbles come from the planet Iota Geminorum 4. So there actually is a tribble homeworld. And there are a couple of interesting points about the tribble homeworld, as well as something that was kind of picked up later on. It's said that the population of tribbles on their homeworld is kept in check by reptiles.
Mm.
That the natural predators on the tribble homeworld are reptiles that hunt the tribbles and eat the tribbles.
Right.
Of course, that would have been when the planet existed, because the Klingons, in their great hatred for tribbles, hunted down the tribbles and actually obliterated the homeworld.
Even the reptilian predators they killed. This seems like an overreaction.
Apparently so. Yeah, it does. Well, that's what Klingons do. You remember the Next Generation episode, The Chase, when they destroyed the biosphere
of
the planet so that no one else could get a DNA sample. It's what they do. Burn the bridges.
Right. Yeah, Tribbles...
The Klingon tactic.
Tribbles seem to have the most interesting evolved way of dealing with predators. You know, most animals that have to deal with predators maybe grow horns, or they become very fast, or they come out only at night. Tribbles just reproduce very quickly, so it doesn't matter how fast you eat them, there's always going to be more tribbles around the next day.
That's true. You know, it's not their only defense mechanism. There are two. There's the reproduction and also just being cute.
Aww.
They're hoping that by being cute, it probably doesn't work with the reptiles, but at least they know that they'll be protected from a lot of humanoid species by just looking cute.
I don't know, Chris. I think even the Gorn captain could not resist a tribble.
Do you think that the Gorn captain goes to the movies and has like a bucket of tribbles, popcorn, just pops them in his
gross.
Mouth?
That's like fried tribbles.
Now
that's all I'm going to be able to think about. Of course, that does sound delicious.
All right.
They wouldn't be cooing.
And I do...
at least.
No. I do think we're going to get a bit of hate mail for this.
Oh, well.
So that's the case. But, you know, I wonder, in all seriousness, the original Klingon aversion to the Tribbles was a plot device.
Right.
To give Captain Kirk some conflict with Koloth. in the episode, The Trouble with Tribbles. Tell me about the first time you saw this episode, because I'm assuming that you watched a number of serious episodes, mm-hmm. and then suddenly you get to Kirk covered in these furry little creatures falling on his head.
Well, you know, I think as a kid, maybe you don't quite grasp the difference between a dramatic episode and a comedic episode. I remember like the film Ghostbusters. I didn't actually realize that was a comedy until I went back and rewatched it a few years ago and realized, oh, wait, they're making jokes. So I think The Trouble with Tribbles actually, I thought, was just a normal episode of Star Trek. And it just happened to have Kirk covered in tribbles from head to toe with them flying at his head. And, you know, if I found it amusing, you know, I probably found other things in other episodes amusing as well. But I think to the adults watching, they definitely picked up on the fact that this was quite a departure for Star Trek.
Yeah, it was fun to see Kirk and Spock and everyone not able to get control of a situation because of some wheat and a bunch of little furry animals.
Right.
Because usually Kirk is so in command and in control and giving orders and making decisions. And here they're in a situation where they are being foiled by Green.
Yeah. And even Kirk is made fun of a few times where he doesn't know what this substance is, where Kirk does and Chekhov does. And he's always at conflict with this guy from the Federation who, I don't know, the guy from the Federation seems to have authority to do what he's done, but Kirk doesn't want to be there and doesn't want to be dealing with this. It's the first time that I can think of that Kirk is out of control, not because there's an actual enemy around, but just because circumstances are foiling his every move. It's a bit like a Shakespeare farce at times.
Yeah, but, you know, the Klingons would tell you that there was an enemy around. There were thousands of enemies around in this episode. And, of course, Chekhov knew what Quadratriticale was because it was invented by a little old woman from Leningrad,
right.
I'm sure. In fact, he says that it was a Russian invention in the episode.
Yes.
What I find interesting here is that Quadratriticale was the only earth grain that was able to grow on Sherman's planet.
Right. Now, what is Sherman's planet? It's an odd name for a planet.
I think that's where Sherman Williams is from, right? Isn't that the biggest paint producer in the Federation?
I thought it was General Sherman from the Civil War. He traveled in time and founded a planet.
Maybe that's it. And actually, I think it's actually Sherwin-Williams, the paint company, right?
I think you're right, actually.
maybe they were supposed to go to Sherwin.
That would have been a completely different episode.
That's right. Well, for those who don't know what Quadratriticale is, of course, I'm very shocked if you don't, it's a high-yield perennial four-lobed grain, genetically engineered hybrid of wheat and rye with a bluish color.
Right.
But, you know, not to be outdone, you know, to power engines in Star Trek, we have dilithium.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, there's some substance called trilithium.
Trilithium, which is that?
Right, which is what Sorin is after in Generations.
Right, quite dangerous.
Right, trilithium. Yeah. And, of course, you have Quadratriticale here, but it doesn't end there. This story is continued mm-hmm. in the animated series in the episode More Tribbles, More Troubles, where they are once again transporting grain to Sherman's planet. Only it's not Quadratriticale, it's
Quintatriticale. That's right. And even Cyrano Jones shows up again, even though he was supposed to be at K7 for something like a couple of decades, cleaning up all the tribbles.
Right. I think they even ask him, you were supposed to be doing that, right? What are you doing here? He does turn up again, and he is, in fact, voiced by the original actor, Stanley Adams, in the animated series episode.
Now, I've not seen too many animated series episodes in the past. Actually, this may be the only animated series episode I've seen. And it was quite interesting to hear so many of the original voice actors. William Shatner, of course, but also in Leonard Nimoy. Even George Takei was in this one. He wasn't even in the original Tribbles episode.
Right. Yeah, it is. That's one thing that lends a lot of credibility to the animated series, as being part of the story of the original series. And in this episode, not only do we have Stanley Adams back doing Cyrano Jones, but also William Campbell is back in here doing Koloth, the Klingon captain as well.
Yeah. Which he so shows up later as well on DS9, I believe.
So. Yeah, it does.
Probably one of the only guest actors to ever be in the original series, animated series, and DS9, especially playing the same character.
Just a few, yeah. That mainly occurred in Blood Oath, where the Klingons come back. And we do have the original actors coming back to reprise the roles. And in the DS9 episode related to Tribbles, Trials and Tribulations, we also had Charlie Brill, who played Arn Darvin in The Trouble with Tribbles, coming back again to reprise that role on Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, it's great how they were able to get those guest actors back in. I don't know that he was terribly recognizable just because so many years had passed. But
yeah, that's true.
But it's good to, if you're going to have the same character, which I believe they had the same character because they knew this actor was available. So they pulled him in and made him part of the script.
Yeah, maybe so. I'm not sure about that. If they would have tried, because I don't know. I say it's integral to the story. Maybe it's not exactly. Mm. The idea was that he used the Orb of Time to travel back to K7 to try to assassinate Captain Kirk, to change history after being foiled by Kirk in the whole Trouble with Tribbles Quadro Triticale incident in the first place. And so that mechanism was kind of needed in order to get the Deep Space Nine crew into that story.
Right.
It was lucky that you already had the Bajoran orbs.
Right.
So they had the Orb of Time that they could use, and it was lucky that that was there because it made it very easy for them to set up that story and make it reasonable for the viewer to believe that it could happen. But so as for Darvin, that was the reason. And had he not been available, I don't know, maybe they would have found another way.
I'm sure they could have
to get them back there.
Something. But getting back to the animated series. So the way that Cyrano Jones was able to clean up K7 so quickly was he got this predator of the Tribbles, which is my absolute favorite thing to reference, which is the Glommer, which is a little predator that actually eats Tribbles. What did you think of the Glommer?
That's right, which was engineered by the Klingons, if I'm not mistaken, right?
I'm not entirely sure why they didn't just bring the predators from the Tribble homeworld, but nevertheless, they had this...
Well, that would have required thinking ahead, and they obliterated the planet, so then they had to go ahead and engineer some sort of Tribble cleaner of their own, which is the Glommer. And if anyone follows Greg on Twitter or Google+, you'll see plenty of references to Glommers.
Yes.
So if you've ever seen Greg mention bringing the Glommer or anything like that, and you weren't sure what he was talking about, this is it.
So it's a little alien that seems to be a sort of a Tribble with legs, and it's
a smooth
Tribble with legs. That's right. It's not hairy.
It's like if you shaved a Tribble and you put octopus legs.
That
on
sounds
it,
about right. So it does is eat Tribbles. Although interestingly, in an early script, the Glommer actually was the main antagonist. It ended up attacking and actually eating humans on the Enterprise.
Oh, gosh.
But then I think they realized, this is a kid's show. We can't have humans.
Yeah.
They don't even show the Tribble being eaten. They sort of cut away.
They cut away, yeah, I know. It's like the Glommer goes over the Tribble, and then they cut.
Right.
Cut scene. Now they're back on the bridge.
Right. It's like they're trying to not get an R rating by not showing a Tribble getting eaten.
Right. So, so the Glommers kind of saved the day in that sense. And interestingly, too, the Tribbles on the animated series, like a lot of things on the animated series, turn out to be pink.
Yes. Which is great, especially in the scene at the end where there's a gigantic Tribble. We haven't talked about why they're gigantic yet, but there's a gigantic Tribble in Kirk's seat. And not only is it gigantic, it's gigantic and pink. Which
that's right. Which is, you know, people have probably, if they haven't seen the episode More Tribbles, More Troubles, they probably have seen that shot, that frame from the animated series of the gigantic pink tribble sitting in the captain's chair. Why don't you explain why there is a gigantic pink tribble here?
So like John Hammond in Jurassic Park, Cyrano Jones is a budding geneticist. And he's decided that what he should do is that because the problem with tribbles is that they reproduce so much, he needs to just change a few things around and make it so they can't reproduce whatsoever. Now, like the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park, life finds a way. And in this case, life finds a way by they may not reproduce, but they become giant tribble colonies that look like 6-foot-tall tribbles.
And then that colony decides to move in to the captain's chair.
And then the colony somehow finds its way into the captain's chair, which is strange because I don't think I've ever seen them with arms or legs. But somehow it moves into the captain's chair, and Kirk tries to push it out of the chair in a very humorous shot on the show.
Okay, yeah, these are the questions you're not supposed to ask.
I know.
How did the colony get into the captain's chair? Shame on me.
So. Please. Somehow.
So in a sense, the original series episode was certainly humorous within the context of the original series.
Yes.
And then the animated series episode is humorous, perhaps more humorous than The Trouble with Tribbles.
I would say pretty much everything in this episode was intended to be humorous. There were even several shots where a character gave a sort of grimace to the camera just to accentuate that someone made a joke there. In case you didn't get it.
Yeah. And I like that camera movement when it's animated, too. Like, and Kirk asks Spock for some kind of course of action, and Spock says, we could shoot tribbles at them. And he says, I thought Vulcans didn't have a sense of humor. And Spock deadpans, we don't.
Exactly. Wah, like, wah.
So, again, the original series episode came first, of course, and then the story was continued in the animated series, and then later on, many years later, as part of Star Trek's 30th anniversary year, we revisited this in the Deep Space Nine episode, Trials and Tribulations, which we were just mentioning a few moments ago.
Right.
And that, in the context of Deep Space Nine, which is really serious, continues the humor.
And I know I heard some people complaining that the music in this one makes everything seem a little bit darker and more serious. But the show still has a very humorous bent to it. You have Worf wearing a handkerchief on his head to cover up the head ridges. And you have a lot of the same humorous scenes from the original show, but now you have our characters like O'Brien digitally inserted into them. But the humor is still there from the original show. It's not like they made it dark and tried to make everything suddenly serious because it's DS9 and that's how we do things.
Yeah, I think the humor, you know, on Deep Space Nine, when we had humor, it was almost always centered around the Ferengi.
That's true.
You rarely you had jokes between Miles and Bashir. You had some of that kind of stuff going on, but you didn't have, like, if it was really, really humor, intended to be a humorous episode, it tended to focus around the Ferengi. And this was a great opportunity for us to get some humor at the expense of the other characters. Odo, who is often sarcastic, was really on his game in this episode. A lot of good jokes at the expense of Worf coming from lots of different characters. As well.
I love that they made, usually there's one character who's really obsessed with a certain time period. Tom Paris, of course, was very obsessed with the 20th century. And in this episode, they made Dax be obsessed with the 23rd century. Sort of like someone who loves the 50s. She loved I forget what the line is, but she loves the bright colors and the chrome accents that's on everything.
Yeah, she says, I love classic 23rd century design.
Exactly. I just thought that was fantastic. The other people weren't quite so enamored, I think, of the ship, but she was sort of the fans' placeholder in the show that we could, she was saying all the things we wanted to say about being on the Enterprise bridge, especially, but just being in this bright universe of 60s Trek.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, she represented us as fans in that episode because she had lived during that time period. So it's like us as fans watching the original series, which was one of the first times that we truly saw it remastered. Because
right.
you remember, this episode was in the mid-90s. I think it was in 96. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the first. It was actually the first time that we saw that new CGI model of the 1701.
Yeah.
That has now been used in all the remastered original mm-hmm. series. Plus the way they, you know, cleaned up the film for the episode so that they could do the insertion. It was one of the first times. And what we felt as original series fans watching what they had done with that episode, she represented us within the episode of this nostalgia and seeing Kirk but there's some more good humor in there, like when they're in the turbo lift and Miles and Bashir don't know how to work the turbo lift. It's kind of like Kirk and Spock being in San Francisco Star Trek IV, very much like
that. And I think, as we talked about on the Star Trek IV episode a few weeks back, I much more like it when they do humor like that that's in the Star Trek universe rather than doing it back to modern day. I really love it. So all of that humor was hilarious. I think a crewman comes in and just shows them up and makes them quite ashamed.
She just grabs the little hand handle and tells it where to go when it goes. And then they both put their hands on handles and kind of look like, oh, yeah, we were doing this whole time.
Of course, they keep changing how all these things work, like between every series. And it seems like even ship to ship, like in the next-gen pilot where Riker doesn't know how to find the holodeck. You know, hasn't he been on 24th century starships before where the computer can tell him?
Well, yeah. Although they did kind of play that up, like the Galaxy class was the first ship to have that capability for the computer to, because there's that woman that shows Riker the panel and shows him how the computer can tell him, and then Riker walks away and she checks him out, you know. but in this episode, you know, one thing that I thought was really well done on the DS9 Tribble story. Of course, you remember that technologically, this seems simple to us now. I mean, this idea of putting the characters in this old episode is like no big deal. But this came very shortly on the heels of Forrest Gump. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Forrest Gump was kind of revolutionary in filmmaking, the way that they were able to put Forrest Gump in the scenes there at the White House. And this came like shortly off the heels of that. And this was kind of a big endeavor to do this episode. So what could have happened was that it could have come off like a gimmick where they're taking the original series episode and they're just putting the DS9 cast in there just to kind of pay homage to TOS and just kind of show, hey, look, we can do this. But instead, it really, for me, comes off as a Deep Space Nine episode. There is a Deep Space Nine story in this episode that is independent from The Trouble with Tribbles.
Right.
That works. You need The Trouble with Tribbles storyline for that story to take place.
Right.
But there is a real DS9 story going on here that comes to a conclusion.
Yeah.
It was done really well.
It's interesting, the history of this episode, in that when they were trying to figure out something to do with DS9 for the 30th anniversary, the original idea they had was to, and you're going to have to help me on this, but there was a original series episode where they went back and it was like the Old West, I believe. And it was a...
Oh, that's Spectre of the Gun.
I believe it's Spectre of the Gun. So they were going to go back to that planet. And instead of replicating the Old West, they now were going to be replicating the original series Federation. And so everyone was going to be walking around in original series uniforms, and it was going to be like a Star Trek convention. Everybody dressed up like that. And that's how they were going to sort of do an in-joke with the series. But then I believe what happened was Forrest Gump came around and they started doing some effects tests and realized, wait, they could actually go and do a story in an original series episode, not just pay homage to it. And I think this works so much better. And there's basically two reasons. And the first, as you mentioned, is it's a real DS9 story. They didn't just tack on some jokes here or there. They actually made a story and made it intertwine with the original series show. And second, the effects work really, really well. There's one shot where Jadzia is trying to sort of just work her way around the bridge to, I believe she's checking in on the computer. And
yeah,
the camera's moving, Kirk's moving, she's moving. And you look at the shot in the original series and it's just a pretty simple shot for the time. But now with Jadzia moving through it, it looks like it was shot brand new for the show. She walks down some stairs just perfectly. And Kirk, I think, even makes eye contact with her at one point. And they...
Oh, I'm sure that Kirk made eye contact with Jadzia. Are you kidding?
They actually talked about that in the DVD behind the scenes, that they cut that a little bit shorter. Originally, it was going to be quite a longer look. But then they said, you know, if he really got a good look at her, there was no way Kirk didn't go over and start talking to her. So we had to make him sort of glance at her and then move on.
That's right. But I don't know if Jadzia would have been interested because, you know, she says, oh, he's so much more handsome in person. And Sisko says, yeah, Kirk had quite the reputation as a ladies' man. And Jadzia says, no, not him. Spock.
Exactly. And I'm sure many of our female listeners agreed that Spock is much more handsome than Kirk.
Yes, many. And that was a great line because that's Jadzia.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, that would be Jadzia's type between the two of them.
Right.
So
maybe Nerys would have been more interested in Kirk. You know, they both have kind of fiery personalities, but
they'd kill each other, I think.
Probably.
But you know, speaking of this as being part of the 30th anniversary, not to get too far away from Tribbles here, but I did just want to say that Voyager, of course, had its 30th anniversary tribute to the Star Trek franchise as well, to the original series. And they also chose to go down a road that worked really well for that series, which was, of course, using footage from Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, and putting Tuvok as having been an officer aboard the Excelsior.
Right, and they took advantage of Sulu not being in the original series Tribble episode, and they put George Takei in the Voyager episode.
Right. But between the two, I thought the Voyager episode was done very well, and it's actually one of my favorite Voyager episodes. The way that they used a believable element from Voyager being Tuvok's, the way the Vulcan mind works, you know, being able to have these flashbacks and using the mind melds, that was believable. And the way they integrated the footage of the Excelsior was also quite believable. However, I think they really got stood up by this Tribble episode on Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
Because this was just so integrated into Star Trek as opposed to just kind of using some elements.
Yeah, definitely. I felt like the Voyager people were told to do an episode, and they did an episode, and they did a good episode of Voyager. But the DS9 people took it a step further and made an episode that, better than really any other episode, encapsulated Star Trek and really... for fans, was like a love letter to the fans and said, you know, you love the original series, we love the original series. A lot like the Mirror Universe episode in Enterprise, which I'm not sure if we talked about, but I really enjoyed the way they paid homage to the original series in that one as well.
Yeah. Speaking of Enterprise, you scared me there. You said love letter, and, you know, the final episode of Enterprise is a... Valentine to Star Trek, according to the writers. And I don't know about that. But yeah, the point you make there about In a Mirror Darkly, the two-parter on Enterprise that goes into the Mirror Universe, but the TOS time period.
Right.
Yeah, that's it was just a beautiful homage to the original series. Yeah. This was the same case. Now, DS9 writers, they did have an advantage over the Voyager writers in that they actually had something within the DS9 universe that allowed for time travel, that they could use, that allowed for time travel that Voyager couldn't use. But
yeah, that's true.
So bringing it back to Tribbles anyway here, and we're still talking about Deep Space Nine, they were able to build some connections between, even though they were using the original series episode, they were kind of able to build on that and do something so that when you go back now and you watch The Trouble with Tribbles, it kind of enhances the experience for you.
Right. And the main instance of this I can think of was when I watched The Trouble with Tribbles today. Of course, there's that classic scene where Kirk has Tribbles pelting his head. And of course, the original continuity, this wasn't really explained. And behind the scenes, we know that it was prop masters just trying to make sure there were enough Tribbles in the scene.
Throwing. I heard they were like
chucking them at William Shatner. There's a point where he glances back sort of angrily at, you know, when are they going to stop throwing these things at my head?
Yeah, yeah. It's enough already.
Right. And now, of course,
it's enough already.
Already. Stop sabotaging my line delivery. Anyway, now we know that there was actually something quite important going on behind the scenes there, where Sisko and Jadzia were looking for bombs, and they were sort of chucking Tribbles as they'd scan one and throw it. And so it makes it something that's never really happened before, where you watch an episode of the original series and you start thinking about DS9. And it brings everything together in this really great way that I don't think has really been matched by any other episode.
Yeah, it kind of makes you wonder, as the Tribbles are falling on Kirk's head, you know, is the bomb in one of them?
Yes.
Is it going to blow right. up suddenly? That's true.
Yeah,
so,
it's interesting. I wonder, in your head, does the DS9 episode, in continuity, does it supersede The Trouble with Tribbles? Do you think that, like, the shot where O'Brien is there instead of other crewmen, is that the way things actually happened for you now, or do you think of it just sort of a amusing side project?
That's a good question. For me, really, I don't give much thought to it. It's fun when you watch The Trouble with Tribbles and you think about these things were going on. You know, I mean, it's fun to do that, but I pretty much watch them as independent stories. Right. I kind of tend to think of it maybe in the sense of the multiple worlds theory,
right,
where, you know, events happen and universes branch off. And so just because this happened in one universe doesn't mean that it happened in the same one, especially now that we have the JJ stuff where we actually have a sanctioned alternate timeline going on.
Right. And of course,
we know things can branch off like that.
Yeah. And of course, you mentioned the JJ movie, and there was a Tribble in that movie. And Tribbles have shown up in many places in Star Trek history.
They have, actually. There was another mention of a Tribble on Deep Space Nine in the episode The Negus, which is one of the places where we learn that reptilian predators on the Tribble homeworld help keep the population in check. And on Enterprise, that same topic is mentioned in an episode called The Breach.
Right.
And there are a couple of movie references to Tribbles as well. There's, if you watch closely in the bar scene in Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, when McCoy is going in, and then Kirk's also going in, talking to the Commodore, the commander, trying to get the Enterprise back, right? And you see all these like people at tables all around in this cafe and all. There are people petting Tribbles.
Oh, really?
On a table there.
I don't think I noticed.
Yeah. And also, there is a reference to a Tribble in Generations as well. There are a couple of more on DS9 that I didn't mention a second ago. These are they're little tidbits all through Star Trek that you can pick up if you really pay attention to the computer screens. As characters are, you know, tapping on screens, viewing records and so forth, an example of a tidbit like that is in Enterprise. You actually find out that Jonathan Archer is the first president of the United Federation of Planets.
Yeah.
And that is never actually said, but it appears when they're checking his records.
Yeah.
I think that's in A Mirror Darkly when
Hoshi
is looking up his records. And in this case, in DS9, in the episode A Man Alone, which is very early first season, and also in The Negus, Tribbles appear on the computer screen in Keiko's classroom.
Yeah.
There's a Tribble information displayed. And one more was that in Generations, which I just mentioned, it's in the science laboratories when the ship has crashed on Viridian 3, the famous crash scene. There's an Elsar's graphic of a Tribble.
Oh, okay.
On display.
Wow.
Yeah. So they've been popping up everywhere, although they've only really been in action in the three episodes that we're talking about today.
Right. But obviously the idea of tribbles has been a big one. We talked about it really permeating pop culture. And the fact that it came back in the animated series and then DS9 proves that people loved the episode Trouble with Tribbles. So I guess my question would be, what do you think about humor in Star Trek overall? Have they done enough humor? Should they do more? Does it sometimes fall a little flat?
Well, I think that it's needed sometimes. I think that for the most part, when they've done humor, it's worked pretty well. The cases where it's worked really well have been either just making it lighthearted, like in the original series where you have an episode like Shore Leave or The Trouble with Tribbles, where it's just really not supposed to be taken seriously. And the humor isn't so much about cracking jokes. It's just putting the characters in a situation, you know, it's like that. Next Generation humor wasn't done quite so often as it was in the other series.
Right.
DS9 had some great humorous moments. Again, they typically centered around the Ferengi, but some of the great humorous episodes, like Little Green Men,
right,
where they crash in Arizona, or in New Mexico, and it's Roswell. Explanation for Roswell was really well done. And of course, the Star Trek IV, the humor came naturally by putting the characters in an unfamiliar environment.
Right.
And then we get the case where it didn't work in Star Trek V, as we've talked about before, where it was very forced. I don't like to have a lot of humor in my Star Trek. That's not why I watch Star Trek. I don't watch it to laugh. I do like to see cases where the characters are fish out of water, though. I think, like, in Deep Space Nine, they needed to throw a few in, like Bada Bing, Bada Bang, in the seventh season of DS9, the middle of the Dominion War, where they just need to kind of let the air out. You know, it's like, you just need a break, and then let's go back to the heavy stuff.
Yeah.
But what about for you? How do you feel about
it? Yeah. A lot of the humor in Star Trek, for me, seems to come from, quote, humorous characters. People like, I'm thinking of Q is often there just for comic relief.
Yeah.
Or on Voyager, Neelix often is just to lighten things up. And it works from time to time, but often it can just be annoying. You know, you want to get back to your real Star Trek. And I think what I prefer is times like Trouble with Tribbles, where they sort of take some time off and just do a funny episode. Where yes, they're put into a circumstance where humorous things are allowed to happen around them, or characters are put into a situation where they just have to make some sort of comment. So that's definitely what I prefer. But I don't know if it's really been done as well as in Trouble with Tribbles. And maybe it's because the whole show was already a little bit campy, and to push it into comedy was just a little bit of a dial turn. Whereas to try to make a comedy episode of Next Gen wouldn't work at all, I don't think.
Yeah, it really wouldn't fit very well there.
Yeah.
It wouldn't fit very well there. And so, yeah, I agree, pretty much. It's just be upfront and say, this is a fun episode.
Right.
You know, don't try to inject humor into an episode just for the sake of having some humor.
Right.
And I would agree that, for me, humorous episodes, the three best humorous episodes are The Trouble with Tribbles, Trials and Tribulations from Deep Space Nine, and Little Green Men from Deep Space Nine.
Little Green Men was actually the one episode I did watch when it aired. I saw the ads for it, and it looked funny. And even though I wasn't a DS9 watcher, I tuned in anyway, and it really stuck with me.
And you found it funny, even though you did not know Quark and Rom.
Exactly.
And Og, right?
Right.
Because it's even funnier when you know those characters.
Oh, yeah, certainly. It was in the middle of the show, wasn't it? Fourth season or something.
It was fifth
season.
Little Green Men was, fourth or fifth season, yeah.
So it was definitely after we already knew
Trials and Tribulations. Yeah, Trials and Tribulations was a fifth season episode.
Oh, okay.
And Little Green Men, I don't remember if it was fourth or fifth, but around the middle of the series.
It was around the middle of the series, so we knew the characters. So by the time I got there in my rewatch, it suddenly had this whole other thing to it where I knew these characters, and I found it so much funnier.
It was when Nog was going to Starfleet Academy, because that was the whole reason they were going to Earth in the first place, was to take Nog to Starfleet Academy.
Indeed.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think we've covered ourselves in enough tribbles for today.
Yeah, I don't think that episode was too much tribble.
Oh, no tribble at all. I sound like Scotty. Okay. Well, before we go today, why don't we tell everyone how to contact us. Tell us your experience with Tribbles, and tell us if you have any other thoughts on anything we talked about or any of the news stories. Mm-hmm. You know, you can always contact us by going to trek.fm/contact. If you want to leave us a voice message, you can do that as well. Just give us a call at 646-652-TREK. And hop over to Twitter and talk some Star Trek with us there. Trek FM's account is simply Trek FM. And Greg, you're on Twitter as well.
That's right. I'm there at Greg Harbin. That's GREGHARB as in boy, IN. Or find me on Google Plus at the same name.
Yep. And I'm on Google Plus as well. You can find me there as well as Twitter, both as C. Brian Jones, CBRYAN Jones. And we'll have links to these in the show notes. Or you can tap your screen there if you're listening to the Enhanced podcast. And you'll find other things over at Trek FM, including our newsletter and Trek Trivia. And you can also follow Trek Trivia on Twitter for live quizzes through the week. And I guess, Greg, that pretty much does it for another show.
Yeah, Chris, I think we can stick a glomer in it, because the Ready Room is done.